Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Hello and welcome. Let's begin today's program with a question. Are you presently battling anxiety, feeling overwhelmed, or routinely stressed out? It doesn't matter what triggers it, an upcoming job interview, pressure at work, rocky relationships. Be it anxiety, overwhelmed, or stress, the underlying emotion we are feeling is fear. Our minds and bodies are racing. We can't think clearly. We can't relate to others, and outside factors seem to be managing us. But here's some good news. Esteemed author and workshop leader Jude Bijou offers 7 simple solutions to overcome fear, and here they are. 1, let the fear energy out of your body. It's perfectly natural to tremble, shudder, quiver, and shake, so go ahead and do so. Don't hold it in. 2, change your thinking. Interrupt thoughts that convince you this will never end. Replace with positive phrases like, this feeling is temporary and it will pass. 3, one thing at a time. Make a list of projects and issues you need to address. Prioritize them and attack one project at a time. 4, prepare a detailed task list. When broken down into doable pieces, your challenges don't look so insurmountable. 5, don't go it alone. Don't play the martyr. Ask friends, family members, and coworkers to help. 6, be gentle with yourself. Interrupt all those self-critical thoughts and lavish yourself with appreciation. And 7, get into the now. Take a short break and ease into the challenge at hand. Close your eyes and take some deep breaths. Walk around the block, whatever works for you. Practice any one of these 7 strategies, and I promise your tension will ease. Do several or all, and you will find yourself calmer, more content, and better able to gain the upper hand. And a ton of additional suggestions on removing fear and taking control of your life can be found in Jude Bijou's book, Attitude Reconstruction, A Blueprint for Building a Better Life. Preview it at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, or Jude's website, AttitudeReconstruction.com. Or treat yourself to 5 days of renewal and life-changing inspiration later this summer. Attend Jude's workshop at beautiful Holyhock Learning Center on Cortes Island in British Columbia from August 9th to the 14th. Check out workshop details on our website. That's attitudereconstruction.com. As we continue our discussion on spirituality, here's an existential question to ponder. Does faith in a divine, loving creator who cares about us as human beings, does that make sense in today's world? Scientific and intellectual discoveries expand our scope of knowledge and understanding at breakneck speed. So why do we need the antiquated image of a God as told in the Bible? It certainly can be argued that in America and Western Europe, organized religion is in serious decline. In fact, atheism, agnosticism, and other forms of unbelief may be growing as rapidly in Western culture as Christianity grew in the first 4 centuries after Christ. In the U.S., Christianity has been losing ground, perhaps not in total numbers except in several mainline Protestant denominations, but in our social institutions and media outlets that shape us as a nation. An acclaimed university professors, scientists, philosophers, novelists, Hollywood producers, print media, and the TV talking heads all are taking pot shots, it seems, at Christian and Jewish beliefs and even the notion of a loving creator as antiquated and out of touch with reality and perhaps relevant in biblical times and throughout the Middle Ages, but certainly not relevant today. And some call it the new atheism or secular humanism. In its simplest form, it proclaims that the natural world is all there is, nothing supernatural exists, and God is a pious fantasy created out of our human desire for continued existence after death and for guidance from a higher power. And as our guest points out in a recent U.S. survey, believing Christians were still a large majority, but note an ominous trend. The number of adult Americans with no religion, as they call it in the survey, is more than doubled from 1990 to 2008, from 14 million to 34 million, and that represents 15% of the U.S. adult population, up from 8% in 1990. And trends like this tend to accelerate, don't they? And my guest today is Shane Hayes, and he's here to help us answer four questions. Are there valid advantages to believing in a divine creator active in human affairs? And are there reasons we should believe in a divine creator? Is it possible to have faith in God without full understanding and acceptance of the complex doctrines of Christianity, Judaism, or Islam? And why are so many people nowadays so skeptical about the existence of God? And how does this skepticism impact our culture? And fourth and finally, what will it take for Christians to win skeptics and hardcore non-believers over? And should we even try? And Shane Hayes has a truly remarkable background with religion because he began as an ardent Catholic and nearly became a Trappist monk at age 17. He then became a militant atheist at 20 and a dilettante in Hinduism and Buddhism in his 20s, a pure theorist, or a theist, I should say, at age 28, and he returned to Christianity at age 30, studying for ministry at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's also served as editor for Prentice Hall and an attorney for the U.S. government, and along the way got married and fathered four children. And perhaps most remarkable, he published his first book, The End of Unbelief, A New Approach to the Question of God, last year in his 70s. And this year he just published his first novel, The Last Dream Girl. Hello, Shane, and welcome. You've had quite a life. It seems like you've done, the only thing you haven't done is play center field for the Phillies.
Well, yeah, thank you. I wish I had done that, but my life is not quite that colorful.
Certainly is interesting. Well, let's start with your personal story. What prompted you to abandon Catholicism at 17 and become a militant atheist?
Well, that was actually at 20. At 17, I almost entered the Trappist monastery.
Oh, okay. After
and,
that
and, one. Yeah, after that. Well, I went to, after my parents withdrew their consent to my entering the monastery at the last minute. I was about to do it.
Yeah.
And then they said, no, we decided you can't do that until you're 21. You need our consent. We're not going to give it. We think you're throwing your life away.
Yeah.
And so then I had to get into a college, and I scrambled and got into a college that September. And for 3 years in college, I, with a little circle of intellectual friends, read secular philosophy.
Yeah.
And it was the reading of secular philosophy and the debates about the existence of God that finally, at age 20, led me to conclude that that there was no God and to become an atheist.
Yeah. Well, you've been there and done that. What are some of the consequences you discovered after becoming an atheist? Wasn't that kind of hollow, or maybe at that age it wasn't? I don't know.
Oh, yes, it was. Well, I guess the key point is that it has advantages and disadvantages, and that's there are reasons for becoming an atheist, philosophical reasons, and there are emotional reasons for becoming an atheist. And what I would suggest is that both figure in to everyone's decision about whether to believe or not to believe.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the impulses to away from belief was that I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a novelist. And I became aware during that three-year period between 17 and 20, as I was reading novels as well as philosophy, that all the novelists that I admired either were atheists or they wrote as if they were atheists. And there was
so
no indication.
Christians can't be a novelist then.
Well, I certainly felt that somebody believing as I did that, you know, that the human drama is a choice between moral good and moral evil, between God and Satan, was not something that would fly in this culture. And that was a reason, an emotional reason for me to be moved toward unbelief. And another major one was sexual freedom.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I had a very tender conscience, and every time I did the slightest thing that was offline in terms of Christian ethics, I had horrible guilt feelings.
Yeah, that's right. I never thought of that. Wouldn't be an
shedding that kind of. Oh, believe me, that's a big one today too.
Yeah.
With the trend toward unbelief, sexual freedom, and that was a big factor. And then philosophically, it was the problem of evil. How can there be a good and loving God with all the suffering that there is in the world?
Yeah, that seems to be a favorite point of the atheists, that they take a short view on that. You know, when you think about take the long view and all the existence continues beyond physical life on Earth, it doesn't, even the worst suffering doesn't sound quite so awful. But
you're absolutely right about that. I don't think I could get by the problem of evil. And I do treat that in the book. I even have God on trial for evil in one of my chapters. I have a 12-page scene with God on trial for evil. But I couldn't win that argument, even with myself, except for the belief in an afterlife.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
if human life is all there is, then I can't see how there could be a good and loving God.
What are some of the disadvantages that you discovered from being an atheist in hindsight?
Let me just give a little story that answers that, I think, dramatically. When I became, first of all, I failed as a writer, at 25. I spent a year and a half writing full-time, plunged into a novel, got 360 pages into it, and failed. And that was my midlife crisis at age 25. I couldn't have the life I wanted. I wasn't as good a man as I thought I was, and that was shattering.
Yeah.
And then there were other things in my personal life that weren't going well, and I became very depressed, so depressed that I thought about ending my life.
Oh.
And while I was struggling with that, I began at a very desperate point to say things like this, that, you know, God, I don't believe in you. I don't have any faith at all. I think faith is stupid. But I wish you existed. I wish you existed, because if you did, you know how to fix me. You could reach inside and fix all that's wrong with me. And I began praying these unbelieving prayers, and then it became the spark of belief, of faith, and of hope, and it got me through the crisis. And I have a friend, one of the four guys that became an atheist when I did.
Yeah.
You know, there were four of us that were talking about all this stuff. We all became atheists.
Yeah.
And one of them, much later in his life, he was about 60, and he reached a point that I did at that age of, you know, 20, 27 or whatever I was at that point.
Yeah.
And he was 60, and he threw himself off the balcony of his high-rise apartment building in California and plunged to his death. Now, if he had had that spark of faith that I had and reached out as I did, his whole story might have had a different ending, as mine has.
Yeah,
and so it can make a life and death difference.
I wonder if I'm sure there are no statistics on this, but I bet the suicide rate among atheists is much higher than it is among believers of any of the...
I haven't seen a survey on that, but I would take that bet. I believe that to be absolutely true.
Another horrible thought of being an atheist is the grief and sorrow from losing a loved one would be so much greater if you had no hope that they were existing on in some form in an afterlife, and you had no hope of ever meeting or seeing them again, which, you know, I know right before my mother died, her eyes brightened up because she was so excited about the thought of seeing my father again. So that, without that, it would be a pretty bleak existence, I would think.
Exactly, exactly. That's a, there's such a difference between their having being gone forever rather than being gone ahead, you know?
Yeah. As you so eloquently presented in your book, The End of Unbelief, when we ponder the existence of a divine creator and afterlife, whether there's anything to that or not, what are the three questions we simply can't escape? You had three questions there that I thought were excellent.
Well, yes, thank you. I said that the questions that keep coming at us. When faced with problems or troubles that seem overwhelming,
yeah,
is supernatural help available or not?
Yeah.
That's one. Second, and that comes to me day after day.
Yeah.
Two, are we ephemeral creatures who expire utterly with our last breath, or is there a spirit in us that survives physical death?
Yeah.
And number three, if death is not the end of human consciousness, if there's a whole realm of being beyond that, is it good or bad? Or might it be either, depending on how we relate to each other and to God while we're here?
Yeah, I always like to think about ponder the thought of whether we seal our entire existence through eternity for the few years we spend here on Earth, which is pretty scary when you think about it that way. But
yeah, it is. But and believe me, atheists hate it when I raise that question. They say that's Pascal's wager, and they just hate it. They hate the idea that there might be a moral dimension to human life,
yeah,
that gives it meaning,
yeah,
and that is, you know, and that our destiny might depend on how we answer that moral question by the way we live our lives.
You know, if you're not a real total hardcore atheist, but an agnostic of some sort, and you believe, in fact, there may be a God active in human affairs, why not live and act on the assumption there is? Because after all, if you're wrong, you'll be gone completely, just as you would if you were hardened atheist. So no harm, no foul. That's what why it makes no sense to me to totally renounce the possibility of a God.
I agree.
I
think some of the best arguments that you can make for believing in God are practical arguments.
Yeah.
I don't think there are some people who there are many, many Christians who feel that we have absolute assurance that God exists, and that the proofs are there, and that there's not an iota of doubt in their minds. But for many of us who can't see that kind of assurance, the question is, rationally, when you look at all the facts, you end up thinking life is a mystery. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't think we can be certain. But
as you point out in your book, God may have wanted us to be unsure and not
exactly
have absolute proof of God's existence.
I don't think I don't. I mean, the God that I believe in, for some reason, wanted human beings to have faith.
Yeah.
He wanted to make faith necessary in human life.
Yeah.
And that's why he didn't make it perfectly clear, and that's why he's hidden.
And human life would be pretty boring without faith, without questions, if we were told exactly what to do and exactly what the outcome was going to be, and we didn't have any room for faith. It would be kind of a boring existence.
That's right, but there's plenty of room for faith, and faith is just as rational a choice now as it was 1,000 years ago.
Oh, of course it is.
And what the new atheists haven't changed that.
Yeah, what prompted you to move from militant atheist to a, as you call it, a pure theist in your late 20s? Indeed, what convinced you that God does exist?
Well, I was philosophically agnostic when I became an atheist. My point is, and I make it in the book, that an agnostic is one who says we can't know whether there is a God or not. His existence can't be proven, and it can't be disproven.
Yeah.
And that's what I was philosophically agnostic. But I chose at a certain point, age 20, to believe that there was no God.
Yeah.
And when I changed at age 28 and I described the emotional trauma that and by the way, the little adage that I have in the book there is, before I describe that, is man's extremity is God's opportunity. Man's extremity is God's opportunity. And that emotional low that I had where I was thinking about suicide was my extremity. And God's opportunity was to reach out to me as I reached out to him in that desperation. So, I mean, it wasn't a philosophical change. It was a feeling that the only way I'm going to get through life is if there's a God to help me.
Yeah.
And so I believed what I couldn't be sure of. And to this day, I believe what I can't be sure of.
Yeah, that's really a leap of faith that I think is required really of everyone that's a believer. I don't know what absolute proof we have of a God. I can't imagine the universe being here as it is without a divine creator. But, I guess we don't have any absolute proof that God exists.
And there are some who think we do, and I don't argue with them. I mean, maybe they're right, okay, but that's, I don't see it as proof.
Yeah, nobody can really tell somebody else what to believe. I mean, you can suggest, point the way, but you, like they say, you can lead a cow to water, but you can't make him drink.
Exactly. But
you describe yourself both as a believer in God and as an agnostic. How can you be both?
Well, that's the point, that that an agnostic is one who says we can't be sure whether there is a God or not. His existence can't be proven, and it can't be disproven.
Yeah.
Now, I can believe, I can see it that way.
Yeah.
His existence can't be proven. So there are two ways to go. If there may be a God or there may not be a God, we can't know one way or the other. The atheist can't know, and I don't think that we Christians can know beyond all question. But we can make a choice. We can decide to hold as true what cannot yet be proven, cannot yet be known. And I, when I was an atheist, I chose to believe that there was no God, and I couldn't be sure of that.
Yeah.
Later, at age 28, I decided to believe that there is a God, and I couldn't be sure of that, but I decided to hold as true that there is a personal and loving God, and that was my one step out of atheism, and I remained in that belief system for 2 years before I could become a Christian, and I did become a Christian, and I had been a Christian now for 47 years, but that's how you can do it. I mean, I philosophically, you can say we can't know, but that doesn't mean we can't make a decision to believe, and to believe is to hold something as true that we can't be sure of.
And
that's what I do.
Well, I like this comment you had in your book. Besides faith, what other attribute is required to believe in God? I thought that was excellent, the way you pointed that out in your book. I'm thinking where you said humility is what also is required.
Oh, interesting. I see your point. Yes.
We think
that's
we're
right.
Smarter than everyone else, including, that there is no God or no one smarter on earth or anyone to turn to, that we know it all, and we're not going to have faith, really.
Well, the new atheists, one characteristic, and I'm not sure if your listeners are aware who the new atheists are, but there are a number of authors, maybe five or more authors, major ones, who have been writing since 2005 and have published major books that have swept the world. But these people not only don't believe in God themselves, but they are contemptuous of believers. They just think that we're stupid to believe, and
that is such that's such ignorance in themselves, really.
It is
that kind of an attitude that we know it all, and you people are stupid if you don't believe like we do.
That's it. There's a quote, and this is something that expresses the view of the new atheists, although they didn't say it. It said the inhabitants of the earth are of two sorts: those with brains but no religion. And those with religion, but no brains.
Yeah, what a
now that was
great
said by
comment.
That was said by an Arab poet in the 11th century, but that is the attitude of the new atheists.
Yeah.
And then we're fighting that. And that is a very effective mode of argument and discourse, and it makes people who aren't well fortified ashamed of being Christian, ashamed of being
believed. Isn't that ridiculous?
It is, but I mean that's the trap.
Some commentators on TV or politicians, not so much politicians, but raise commentators, and it's almost like you're putting a Christian and express that belief, and it just shows you're out of date and you're ignorant and
you don't
have enough intelligence of your own to rely on, so you have to rely on the Bible. And I mean, that kind of ridiculous. They're subtle put downs usually, but. Well, how does the increasing skepticism about God's existence have a negative impact on Western culture and on really welfare, human welfare worldwide? What are some of the impacts of this increasing skepticism?
Well, of course, one aspect of it is in sexual morality. When I was a kid. A long time ago, when two unmarried people would live together, they would refer to that as shacking up.
Yeah.
You know, just very negative.
Sense.
They shacked up. You know, that was something else. Well, now the sons and daughters of even many of my Christian friends are living together out of wedlock, and they think nothing of it.
Yeah,
they don't even say, I'm not a Christian.
Trial.
They just do it.
Don't make commitment. You try it out before you make the final commitment.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, the point is that the whole and one reason that it's so much easier today is that back then there was a social stigma to violating the norms of Christian behavior, sexual behavior. That's gone now.
Yeah.
Okay, you say, how's it changed? That's gone. So now, I mean, you have huge numbers of children out of wedlock, and you have a much higher incidence of broken marriages and broken homes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's certainly one aspect of it.
Yeah, that's a good example of that. Well, let's ask a few questions for those of us who are Christians. Going forward, what do you see as the biggest challenge to Christianity? Is it from outside forces like radical Islam, or is it more through increasing rejection in the Western cultures and the notion of a benevolent creator? What do you see as the biggest threat going forward to, or biggest challenge?
Yeah, well, I don't see it as Islam. They're going to... they're going to behead a lot of Christians before they're finished, and they've done some of that. But they won't be the downfall of Christianity. It's interesting that just a little quote from Scripture in Luke 8:18, Jesus said, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?"
Yeah.
It's interesting that he raised that question, as if he foresaw a time when faith would be threatened in a dire way in the future. And I see the creeping secularism. I see the increasing dominance of the no God atheistic agnostic viewpoint spreading in our society, becoming fashionable in the places that hold believers of power in our culture, the universities and the media and the arts and so forth, that I see them as radiating an influence that is so powerful that the churches simply are. Being minimized and swept aside by that, and one major problem that I see is that first of all, the churches seem to be in denial. They don't seem to be willing to face this ominous trend that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's
true. It's as if a culture war is raging in America, and only one side is fighting it. Skeptics are working tirelessly to convert believers to unbelievers. Christians are doing almost nothing to convert unbelievers to believers.
Yeah, you point out that so much of Christian evangelism these days is ineffective in winning over these hardcore atheists and agnostics. And what is the reason that you think that the Christian evangelism is so ineffective nowadays?
Well, I think it's because the churches are not historically they're not used to dealing with hardcore unbelievers. They're, the church is used to dealing with what I call the apathetic believer or half believer,
the backsliders.
The person that says, "Yeah, I know I should go to church, but I find it boring. I don't have time. I go Christmas and Easter." Yeah. Now that's the apathetic believer, and that's what their outreach is geared for.
Yeah.
They don't recognize that the hardcore unbeliever, the agnostic and atheist, that these people are a completely different mindset.
Yeah.
They're not just indifferent to what we're offering; they're hostile to it, and they'll attack us. I mean, they don't like Christianity. They've been there, done that. They've rejected it, and they'll fight back and they're pretty sharp arguers. And so the church seems to have no strategy for reaching out to the hardcore unbeliever, which is what my book is designed to do, having been an atheist, and I had to talk to them.
Yeah, that's what's so outstanding about your book. Well, let's say that I'm an ardent atheist who has come across your book, but I'm, quote, too smart for outdated religious doctrine, and I'm reading it mostly for amusement and to scoff. What is there in your book that might convince me to at least open up to the possibility that God exists?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that, but I'll give two.
Yeah.
And one is that the atheist is going to be very taken back on the first page of chapter one, where I say, "I am a Christian, I am an agnostic."
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a connection that I make with them in that way, where I make it clear that you can be an agnostic and a Christian. You don't have to give part of the good news that I hold out to the unbeliever is that you don't have to give up your spirit of skepticism to become a believer.
No.
Okay, that's a different approach.
The best way to become a real believer is to be a skeptic. Accept everything without challenging it in your mind from childhood, that's fine. But I think what you went through probably has made you a much stronger believer than you would have been if you just stayed a believer all your life and not really challenged anything.
I believe that is absolutely true. And the other thing, the other point besides that good news, I mean, that nobody else is saying that I know of, okay?
Yeah.
And so that would, if you have somebody who has any kind of openness to believing, that it makes a very quick connection. This is different, okay? This book is different. This guy's approach is different from what I've heard. The other thing is that I argue for what I call pure theism, which is that when I came back, I couldn't come back to the whole complex constellation of Christian doctrines. There was just too much, but I could take that one step out of atheism to belief and connection with a personal and loving God, not otherwise defined, not the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament, God of the Quran, just God. And that's an idea that people can't generally divorce that from the organized religion that they've come to dislike. And I'm saying you can divorce that.
If you can
just
even
God.
Take one further step and start communicating in some way with that God.
I make that point in the book. First, I talk about pure theism in chapter I think 11 or 12, and then in the next chapter, I actually walk them through what I call a thought experiment. Reaching out in prayer to a personal God that you don't even believe in at this point, but just experiment with a possibility. And so that's a difference in the approach. And I had to go through 2 years of that before I could become a Christian.
Hmm.
And what's interesting is that the most admired Protestant Christian writer of the 20th century, in my opinion, was C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And he, too, he became an atheist at 15, and at age 31, he became a theist. He came back and took that one step out of atheism, and he, like me, had to remain a theist for 2 years before he could become a Christian. Hmm. So that's an approach that I advocate in the book, which nobody else is pressing for, which can help an awful lot of people take that one step out of atheism, whereas the whole thing is overwhelming to them.
Yeah, and you're really taking that one step out of atheism. You're really not risking anything, as far as I know.
Not at all. nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Yeah, and then why should you be so resolute that there isn't a God when obviously there is a possibility of a divine creator?
Exactly.
Well, what's the best place we can go to preview and purchase your book?
There are excerpts of it on my website, which is shanehaze.com. ShaneHayes.com, one word, Shane Hayes, S-H-A-N-E-H-A-Y-E-S.com. And then you can buy it. It's available online at Amazon.com and at Barnes & Noble, BN.com. And at any bookstore, it probably won't be in the bookstore, but they can order it for you. But the easiest way is just Amazon.com, The End of Unbelief, A New Approach to the Question of God by Shane Hayes.
Yeah, and you also have a brand new novel, The Last Dream Girl. Is that available yet, or is that I know?
Yes, that's out. That's out, and it's available in the same places. And it was a long time coming, but I must say that I think it's a really good story, and I think people would like that.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we don't have time to get into that, but that's fascinating that you would write that novel after you finished your. Trieste, your great book on unbelief. But in conclusion, I think Shane Hayes' message is very simple, special to me, because he emphasizes that it's perfectly okay to be both a believer and an agnostic or a skeptic, and I haven't the slightest doubt in my mind that there is a loving divine creator, and I can't even begin to comprehend how a God that created a vast universe beyond imagination could still be concerned about you and me on this tiny planet. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't, or that God doesn't exist and doesn't have interest in us. And I do have trouble with the notion of an Old Testament God who instructed the Israelites to wipe out all the prior inhabitants of the promised land that they were to occupy. And I have problems with uncompromising Christian doctrine that dictates that God provided one and only one pathway to eternal life, and all other inhabitants of this world are facing eternal damnation. I've always had problems with that, but as made clear in Shane's book, winning over hardcore non-believers is a one-step-at-a-time process, and we don't have to convince them that everything in the Bible is absolutely relevant to them at this point, but start by asking for an open mind. There's no proof that God doesn't exist, and there's a lot of good reasons why the world is better off because God does exist. And then you describe all the wonderful benefits you have experienced personally from believing in a divine creator. And I certainly personally wouldn't want to adopt an atheist point of view that my current brief sojourn on earth is all that there is in store. And especially depressing is as those of us in middle age in life's second half, as we near the end of our earthly journey. And Shane Harris's book, The End of Unbelief. Shane Hayes's book, The End of Unbelief, presents an inspirational but not too demanding alternative to non-belief. Just keep an open mind and ponder the wonderful benefits of belief in God. And if you're struggling with your belief or you know someone who is, I highly recommend that you preview and purchase Shane's book. And thanks a million, Shane Hayes, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And best of success as a first-time novelist and as an esteemed nonfiction author. And you are a definite inspiration that fullness of life needn't end at the normal retirement age.
I'm 76 and going strong. Thank you, sir.
Last week, I suggested you take an inventory of all the negative aspects of your life today, not just to identify the negatives, but to understand when and where they came from and why they continue to bug you today. Of course, your ultimate objective is to purge every negative thought that is holding you back. But As you crowd negative thinking from your consciousness, what can you replace it with? You're not about to run around like a hollow-brained zombie, are you? So where do we locate some positives to populate your consciousness? Answer: the same personal warehouse of your subconscious inside you. It's time to take an inventory of all the positive aspects of you and your life, circumstances, and who you are, either today or in the past years, the best years of your past. Your life today may be far from ideal, but every one of us has positives to build upon. And here are a few possibilities. First, positive characteristics of you. What about you as a person do you admire most? And I'm certain every one of us has some aspects that they admire. How about your appearance, intellect, fitness, athletic ability, courage, spirit of adventure, imagination, outgoing personality, loyalty, trustworthiness, calmness under pressure? I mean, these are just a few of the aspects that you and I can be proud of, that obviously we're not all of those things, but we can pick out the positives. And do you make friends easily? Are you a fast learner? There's all kinds of things about you that you can be proud of. Second, your talents and accomplishments, talents you've demonstrated now or in the past, or how about those hidden talents that you know you have but you've never developed? How about for a third positive circumstance, positive life circumstances like sound finances, your family, a loving spouse, offspring and parents, who can replace a loving family? Domicile and geographic location, maybe you love your present house or a past house you've lived in, and you love the city or the general geographic area where you currently reside. That's certainly a positive life circumstance to build upon. How about positive aspects of your work day and career? Even if you don't like your job, every aspect of it overall, there's certainly some things about it that you like, that you can dwell upon. And maybe you can think about some past jobs, those that you most admired and enjoyed. What did you like about those? A fifth area are warm relationships, past and present, with persons you love, respect, and admire. They may be immediate members of your family, obviously your spouse and children, but perhaps a teacher, a co-worker, a boss, someone that you admire and really mentored you and helped you along the way. Think of those warm relationships. And finally, think about positive impacts that you have had on others. That's obviously part of being happy and fulfilled, is having a positive influence on someone else. It's not all about ourselves. Your own children, perhaps, young people you have taught, coached, or mentored, maybe elderly nursing home residents you visit, maybe people who work for you, people that you have inspired in your career. There must be a number of people that you've helped along the way. And once you identify your positives, relationships, characteristics, and circumstances, the first thing to do is express gratitude for all the blessings in your life today, as well as for joyful past experiences. You know, thank God, the eternal being, and others who have helped you along the way and whose very presence brightens your day. I'm certain you know that expressing gratitude increases your reward. And now, to positively move forward, ask yourself some questions. Which positive aspects of me and favorable circumstances are a major influence on my life today? And on those bittersweet memories from the past, why are these things no longer present in my life today? Can lost relationships and circumstances be restored, recaptured, or at least replicated with similar type relationships and circumstances today? Which dormant or hidden talents can I apply? How should I develop, practice, and bring them out? Now, the most important part, and that's building upon your identified potential brought to light by your inventory of positives, past and present. Treat yourself to a steady diet of positive mind pictures of your bright tomorrow. Visualize in vivid detail the life you are building for yourself beginning today. And remember, this is not a fantasy. This is the career, lifestyle, and relationships you know you're capable of, and you can build on based upon the positives that you have identified. Studies of human behavior demonstrate that by concentrating on positive aspects of you and on your goals for the future and visualizing a successful ultimate outcome, you will transform your dominant outlook on life from negative to positive. No longer why something can't be done or why you're bitter because someone else has more than you do, into an unlimited possibility that you're capable of, that we're all capable of. Like me, you may have unconsciously spent many years reinforcing negative expectations, but now you will transform your dominant outlook on life from negative to positive. I trust this past week you spent time and effort identifying negative aspects of your life, bringing them to the surface, and purging them as your dominant frame of reference. This week, you will concentrate on positive thoughts and images to replace them with. And believe me, a positive outlook and favorable expectations can make all the difference in the world. Your life will become infinitely better with that positive outlook. A renewed positive outlook on life and life renewal is what my first book is all about. That's A Midlife Challenge Wake Up by Roy C. Richards. You can check it out on barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com, or our website, middleagerenewal.com. And while you're on our website, check out our bookstore. We feature some of the best books written by past guests on this program. We also include a few classics on reinvigorating life at midstream, all in a handy single location, so you don't have to go to a giant website like Amazon to find the books that really concentrate on midlife renewal. And that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week and to discover why things really do happen for a reason. That's what our guest will talk about. See you then. Goodbye for now. From Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.